You exude zombie takeout. Can you see that?
Hello and welcome to Zombie Takeout, the B-movie and cult movie show. I'm John.
And I'm Scotto.
And we have a little bit of, well, we had quite a bit of feedback, but it's once again, Bodo live tweeted the movie. This time I'm just going to retweet everything when this episode goes live. So check our Twitter to see what he said. Link down in the description. And without any further ado, on to this week's movie, which is from 2018, Mandy. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Red Lights. They're not just for sex workers anymore.
But also brought to you by Cheddar Goblins. It's goblin good and not nearly the most disturbing thing in this film. All right, so we have a lumberjack.
And he's okay.
He is okay. Until, well, a vicious cult spots his lady. I don't think they ever say if they're married or whether they're just cohabitating.
I don't think it really mattered. It didn't specify.
It is interesting how they handled the relationship part in the beginning because it's a fine line.
I suspect probably a common law thing.
Something like that. Who knows? She's very much interested in, you know, fantasy and metal and you know, so you think maybe she's susceptible to joining this cult, except they really don't give her much of a choice. They just kind of drag her into a room. They drug her up. He makes the mistake of playing some of his music for her. And then he
gives him something even more laughable. He shows her something even more laughable.
He pulls out his ace. Or it's the Rocky line. Looks like a Joker. right. So she just she does not react in the way he imagines she would, and his response to this is to burn her alive and make her boyfriend or significant other watch. Now, the classic James Bond villain mistake. You just leave the
guy tied up. Yeah,
tied up.
You don't kill him.
You don't kill him. You just leave. Which, of course, as soon as this man Red gets free,
and bear in mind he was tied up with barbed wire.
Yes. As soon as he gets free, we have, of course, the classic revenge movie. And
on 11.
Yes, yes. He forges his own weapon. There's just so much to this where he just goes, retrieves his crossbow and goes into the woods after to follow this cult. And you can almost say hilarity ensues at this point without giving the rest of the movie away.
It is just a revenge film at that point.
It is. It is the way, you know, I could not tell you the plot to Beyond the Black Rainbow from the years we saw it, but this plot is just that simple.
Yeah. She gets kidnapped by the cult. They establish that they have a nice little relationship living in the middle of the woods. She gets kidnapped by the cult.
They leave him alive.
Yeah.
And then he comes after them and makes them pay.
And this was directed by Panos Cosmatos, same director as Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is why you referenced it.
Yes.
And as a result, I was both dreading and eagerly looking forward to this movie. Black Rainbow is still the most disturbing film that I have ever seen. It haunts me more than 4 years later.
I really want to go back and watch it again after this.
I am almost tempted to revisit it after seeing this. Almost. Panos Cosmatos said that both this and Black Rainbow an inhale and an exhale. Complete thought in two parts. So they're companion pieces. They're also really? both set in the year 1983. So, but it's not nearly as disturbing as Black Rainbow, as we were talking about ahead of time.
Well, right. There's something very psychological about Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Beyond the Black Rainbow, it kind of feels like they always tell actors you shouldn't look into the camera because it's creepy.
Right.
Beyond the Black Rainbow, the entire movie feels like it's looking straight into the camera.
They only do that once in this.
And it's laughable.
Like when the cult leader is talking, that scene is fucking freaky as hell.
Now that's interesting because I laughed at that scene. I was wondering if I should be laughing, and then she laughed, and I figured, okay, you're supposed to laugh at that part. No.
When he's like, he does something with the camera, like he's talking,
and their faces shift. His face shifts to her face, which was brilliantly done.
Yeah, he shifted to her face, and you're like, wait a minute, that's no longer him. Wait, that's her. I think my head almost.
I just thought it was funny.
Blasted the headphones away.
I mean, the face swap was brilliantly done, but beyond that, I just thought the scene was funny. Because he's going on about how, you know, he was at a low point in his life, and he somehow talked to God, and God told him that he deserves everything he ever wanted.
Right.
It's just this total male entitlement bullshit that I just thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
And then he opens the robe, and she laughs at him. He put the music on first. Then he goes on this rant about how he's this entitled male.
She makes the valid point of, so this is a song
that you wrote about you. Yeah, yeah. Way before that, though, rolling back to the beginning, gotta credit the opening song. Great choice.
Holy fuck. My notes say they put King Crimson in. Is this Five Brains already? We're only 2 minutes in.
Opens up with Starless by King Crimson off the album Red, which I thought was a nice touch.
Of course, everything about this movie is red.
Yeah. Lots of red light. Also noticed in the opening credits an actor named Ned Dennehy. I had to check. He's not related to Brian.
I did too, yeah.
But I love the opening title font. It is so metal. Everything about this movie just screams metal.
Oh, right.
From the opening title font. And Cage is completely emo right off the top.
He's trying so hard to not be Nicolas Cage, in the beginning at least. He's trying to be as subdued as possible, and just, you know, it's just very low key. It just, you know, okay.
And of course, you know, even in that part of the movie, it works because it's supposed to be weird.
Well, right, and they're supposed to just be a normal couple, really. I thought, yeah. You know, and it's handled brilliantly, I thought, because, well, this, we're recording this like after the premiere of Game of Thrones for the final season, for those of you listening to us in the future. And the biggest complaint about this week's episode has been they have a relationship going on. Well, it's the same thing here.
Even though they telegraphed that at the end of last season, but continue.
But it's the same deal here. If there's no relationship, if he doesn't give a fuck about her,
there are no stakes.
There's no stakes. There's no sacrifice. There's nothing. The movie and the show would both not work.
Yeah.
If you do not have that emotional investment.
Right.
However, the emotional investment here is just done so brilliantly. It's so understated. And so, yeah, they're just a couple. They've been together for God knows how many years.
That's why I said probably common law, because it feels like they've just been together for like over a decade.
The fact that we don't even know if they're husband and wife or boyfriend or girl speaks volumes, because, you know, how would that come up? You know, it wouldn't come up in like, oh, you know, we've been married for this amount of years. It would be some stupid, corny dialogue like that. But instead, you believe it, you know? They're just hanging out together and talking about metal and fantasy.
And it's this very sweet romantic beginning that you know is just going to make the end part, the second half of the movie, that much more brutal.
Right. You know, I had not looking.
Yeah, you don't like
spoilers.
You avoid spoilers. I had a basic story arc for the movie.
It was tough to see where this was going exactly. If she was going to willingly join the cult with and, you know, leave with them, and he was going to chase after them, or if, you know, what happened.
Right.
what really did happen.
And you knew it was going to get weird when they show the title, the card for, you know, their little house in the woods. Shadow Mountain is 1983. But it's not just a little chyron at the bottom of the screen.
Right.
It's this whole full screen, very heavily designed, very 70s logo. Sparkly. That says Shadow Mountains, something about 1983, yeah. And there's great chemistry between Cage and Andrea Riceborough, who plays Mandy.
Yeah.
They really do feel like they've been together forever.
And, I mean, neither are Hollywooded up. I mean, she...
No, no.
It's like she's not even wearing makeup in this.
No, she...
Which is so punk rock.
She looked... Oh, I was surprised. I just was, you know, looked her up to see if I'd seen her in anything. She looks completely different in everything else.
Right. It's just like they just out there, it's they're in nature, and you know, she's not one to get all dressed up, so there you go.
And
the Motley Crue shirt 1983 is
I think probably around one of their first albums was probably 83.
Right. Pre-Theater of Pain, not many people outside.
Well, that was the great thing, because before that it was Black Sabbath, or after that it was Sabbath.
Yeah.
Early Crue. Like, that was just a really nice touch. Cosmatos knows this era.
I think it was intentionally used, that shirt, though, for the pentagram.
Possibly, you know, yeah.
That occult image,
you know,
this was going.
I'll admit I am deliberately wearing a Rasputin shirt tonight because of the cult leader angle. But, you know, once they establish that they have this really sweet relationship in the middle of the woods, we get a couple of really creepy dream sequences.
Yeah.
First one, we have Mandy in the water, kind of looking a little Apocalypse Now, like just her head sticking out of the water as Red's making a fire. And then she just walks up to the beach, walks up towards him through the water with this kind of severe look on her face. And then we get Mandy running through the woods, and these you know, beautiful green woods, not just the leaves, but the background is green. It's beautifully shot. And she finds a dead deer.
Oh, I think it was lamb.
Or lamb, okay, perhaps.
Because there's some people speculating, I saw somewhere that that was a reference to Silence of the Lambs.
Okay, possibly. Or just Lamb to the Slaughter.
Which is a very... I'm not sure why this movie would reference Silence of the Lambs exactly. Yeah,
that doesn't make sense.
But she's... like the starlets or whatever... Like, it was like Clarice's last name.
Right, Starling. Clarice Starling, yeah. She has a Starling story after that reminded me a lot of Upstream Color.
Right, the Starling story has no place.
No.
But logical place in the dialogue at all.
But the lamb makes more sense, because she is the lamb being brought to the slaughter.
Yeah. But yeah, the Starling story, she brings up in response to Cage... suggesting that maybe they should move out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, once you hear that, you're kind of like, oh, she's not going to go willingly. This is going to be brutal. That's kind of when I figured it out.
And that's when the creepiness starts ramping up. That and the dream sequences. Because that's when we get the kind of dark electronic music and the Starling story. And the beginning of the movie, did you notice, was very quiet.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I had to crank my volume up.
Mm-hmm.
We also, when she's reading her fantasy book, we have this weird vocal effect on the text. You know, someone reading the text.
There's so many different vocal effects and just things used in this.
And then she sees him, or then he sees her, Jeremiah, the cult leader.
Yeah.
And we get the first red lighting. Because red lighting is a thing throughout the movie.
There were kind of red lights before that, like in other fantasy sequences and whatever. But this was when it was like, it got turned up to 11. There was red and purple and fuchsia. Like, it was, I don't think I've seen anything like it in a film before, honestly.
And then we suddenly get the name of the cult full screen.
Yeah.
Like the Shadow Mountain thing. I appreciate that Cosmatos doesn't give a shit about reality.
No. Nicolas Cage gets pretty much treated like a pincushion in this movie, and yet he just like bounces back somehow.
He makes no effort to make it realistic, which I love. He just goes, David Lee Roth, he leads with his face straight into the emotional impact and, you know, what sets the scene.
In fact, I would say that they suggest that Cage gets some sort of superpowers by the end of the film.
Possibly, yeah. Yeah. He's kind of immortal, like any action hero.
Like that, I think it was that form of LSD or whatever, mm-hmm. that the Dark Knight, the Dark Knights, the Dark Guys.
The Black Skulls.
The Black Skulls took.
Yeah, he's out to kill this demonic biker gang who kidnapped her. And he, while at their hideout, he tastes this substance that he pulls out of a fridge, and he immediately has this bad trip.
Right.
And I don't know if it was supposed to be acid so much as maybe PCP, because bikers.
Yeah, I was thinking it's more of a bath salt thing, honestly.
Yeah, something along those lines, yeah. By the way, Panos Cosmatos originally wanted Cage to play the cult leader.
Right, I couldn't see that working, honestly.
Yeah, Cage said he was more interested in Red. They couldn't come to an agreement. And then a year later, they met again through Elijah Wood, and they discussed it more. And then Cosmatos said that he was originally planning it to be a youth versus age thing, which is why he wanted a younger actor to play Red. But then Cage talked him into it, and, you know, it obviously worked out.
I almost thought he wanted Elijah Wood to play Red at first.
Maybe. That would have been an interesting choice. Would have fit his original vision.
The fact, though, that that the guy playing Jeremiah and Nicolas Cage are the exact same age.
Mm. also, loved all the strobe lights, particularly on the horn of Abraxas.
Right. I was very surprised that it was actually a horn. Like, what?
And not a horn like on the head, but a horn you blow through.
Right.
That's how Brother Swan, Ned Denny, calls the Black Skulls. And then apparently it becomes Hellraiser.
Yeah. Well, they're
a little after we get kind of the establishment of life in the cult.
Yeah, they do the dirty work, at least. I'm not sure the relationship between the cult and them. It's kind of weird, but
I kind of feel like they make deals with them because they were offering a sacrifice when they, you know, the Black Skulls came in and they did the job and then said, we want blood.
Yeah.
And they sacrificed one of the low ranking cult members to them.
Yeah.
Earlier in an earlier scene, Swan and Jeremiah were joking about, you know, how they're going to get rid of the fat guy. So he was the one who they gave to the Black Skulls to presumably be, you know, exsanguinated. But yeah, he's not just a charismatic cult leader, or, you know, not just delusional and entitled. He actually commands demons, although not maybe not necessarily demons in the strict sense, because there's a story later about how they got a bad dose of drugs and then just turned masochistic.
Right. And the fact that Red hears this story and then goes and takes the drugs anyway.
Yeah,
it was kind of, and let's of course talk about that scene where he is hearing the story, and that's of course after she's mm-hmm. she's killed and he breaks free.
Right.
It seemed like they started going into these weird Shining references,
mm-hmm.
like that bathroom that he goes into to down all that vodka. Right. That wallpaper is, I mean.
Well, no, that was way before the story. That was right after he escaped.
Well, right. So after he escapes, that he goes into this bathroom, and I swear the wallpaper is pretty much the same pattern as the floor of the carpet to the Overlook Hotel from The Shining, because it's just this weird...
I would not put that past Cosmatos at all.
And the only reason, of course, I know this is because we saw that room 227. Mm-hmm. Where they point out the carpet in the Overlook Hotel and how there are things missing or patterns changed, uh-huh. or whatever. But it's almost the exact same pattern. And then he goes to get his crossbow from a bald black man,
mm-hmm.
not named, you know, Crothers, but Carruthers.
Who looks quite a bit like Batman.
Yes, he does. He doesn't sound like him, but he looks like him.
Panos Cosmatos has a knowledge of that period that is very along the lines of the Duffer brothers who do Stranger Things. They both know the era cold. Obviously, Cosmatos goes a little creepier than they do.
It's kind of cool to see an R-rated Stranger Things, though, without the kids.
But the pacing in this movie is really impressive, because she doesn't get kidnapped until about a half hour in, but it doesn't drag in the slightest.
No. Well, because you see all these weird visuals within that first half hour. And King Crimson.
Yeah. And there's this great shot right after they kidnap her, where it's just the demons in the woods that needs to be a metal album cover.
Yeah. Some band just need... I'm surprised they didn't get like some metal band to play the part.
Yeah. I don't know who they got. I don't know, recognize any of the actors' names. I'm guessing they're probably all stunt performers since they don't really have lines.
Yeah.
Again, more strobe lights when she was being kidnapped. And I'm wondering, she had this scar under her left eye. And I'm wondering if that was maybe what tipped him off, that she was special.
I don't know.
You know, because there was more to it than just he was attracted to her.
I'm not sure what any of that was, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, what his attraction to her was, what it was that he found so that he special needed, about her. Yeah,
why did he need her? I'm thinking maybe it's the scar. They never allude to it. I'm just, you know, grasping at straws here. Now, what I wasn't prepared for was the giant wasp. Because they have her tied up at a table in the cult leader's headquarters. And they say, you know, your husband's... They refer to her to him as her hubby at that point.
Oh, you're right.
And they say he's fine and he'll stay that way as long as you behave. They drop some acid into her eye. And then they pull out this giant wasp. And when I say giant, it was about 6-7 inches long, and they stick it into her neck, and it looks incredibly fake. Like they don't try to make it look realistic, which I love.
Right.
And then we get this scene with Jeremiah in this robe that looks like something Rush would have worn in the early 70s.
Yes.
And he, you know, he plays his music and he goes on about this rant about how he's this chosen one who deserves everything, you know, deserves everything he wants. And so he just takes it. And I, like I said, I just laughed through that whole thing because he's just being this delusional, whiny child.
Well, right. I mean,
who honestly mistook his own ego for a supreme being.
Yeah, the stuff he's saying is completely stupid, but the way it's shot is fucking creepy as hell.
I thought it was more interesting than creepy. I thought it was a nice touch, but it looked very 70s B movie to me.
And you're kind of wondering, like, is she going to, like, fall for this or not? You know, like, is she, like, you're kind of at that point, like, is she going to get taken in? Is she going to actually go with this? So the answer is, of course.
And then she just laughs at him. One of my favorite moments in the movie.
This is really good.
This is after he opens the robe and is not wearing anything underneath. And she just laughs at him.
And like she's more terrifying than he is at the end.
And at that point, it was kind of starting to feel like a parody of itself, but in a really good way. Like it's totally self-aware.
Well, like when he's loading up and Carruthers is, he's telling Carruthers, don't be negative. He's like, you're probably going to die.
Well, because he's going up against this legendary biker, you know, biker gang who are possibly demons. You know, it's like the Hell's Angels, but superhuman.
He's going up against the whole cult.
Oh, and the whole cult. But I mean, the bikers were the ones, the Black Skulls were the ones he was really warning him about. And basically telling him, don't do it.
Yeah.
Because you will be killed. Also, I did not expect Mandy to die.
Well, right.
And
that's what I'm saying. Yeah, you really don't expect that.
And I would pull that as a spoiler, but you can't spoil this movie.
And it happens quite early.
Yeah, it happens like just past the halfway mark. And so, you know, it surprised me though, because I thought it was going to be a classic happy ending. But I guess you don't really have a revenge movie if he just goes back and recaptures her and, you know, just frees her from the kidnappers.
Well, yeah, just assume that that's what this was about, that he was going to, you know, chase them down and, you know, get her back somehow, or, you know, lose her in the process, or, you know, find out that she willingly joined them or something like that.
Yeah.
I almost didn't even believe that she was actually in the bag.
Same. I expected her to come back somehow. But they committed. They actually killed her off. loved the Cheddar Goblin ad that you were referencing in your sponsor. That was actually filmed for the movie. Obviously, it wasn't a real ad.
Yeah.
I think all of the other stuff on TV and on the, in the music and all was all period.
Yeah.
You know, the movie they were watching earlier and all of that was correct. You know, from the time Cheddar Goblin was made for the film. It's this not CG, but kind of like claymation goblin.
Yeah.
Selling mac and cheese.
Vomiting mac and cheese onto kids.
Onto a kid to sell it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And after that, we get these cartoonish nightmares. Actually, not cartoonish, but actually cartoon nightmares.
Yeah.
That go throughout the rest of the movie that I thought were really interesting, really well done. That's the point where he just completely lets go of any semblance of reality.
Oh, yeah. It's on there. That's when they let Nicolas Cage be Nicolas Cage.
And that's when we get the scene where he's chugging the vodka or something, some kind of clear liquor, probably vodka.
Yeah, I think it was
vodka. Sitting on a toilet, you know, and at one point he pours it over his wounds.
Yeah, he has a full knife wound in his fucking side, by the way, that, you know, he never gets bound or anything that, you know? There's no
and he's got, healing. His arms are all cut up in his face from the barbed wire, and he's just screaming at first, repeatedly screaming, chugging this vodka, and that eventually, once all the shock wears off and he's appropriately drunk, turns into crying. It was just Nicolas Cage going full Nicolas Cage.
And of course, the real treat of the movie is like, okay, I have to see how he's going to get these fuckers back.
And he makes this giant axe.
Yeah, he makes an axe.
He's somehow gone from a lumberjack to a metal worker. Like, as you see him, pouring the metal and into a mold and everything. Someone suggested that the axe was an homage to Celtic Frost because it kind of matches their logo.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen anything official about that. That was just somebody on IMDb suggesting it. And I think we saw the actual title of the film at the hour 15 mark.
Yes, the title of the film is like 70 minutes in.
Panos Cosmatos does not give a fuck.
No, he does not.
And this is the second movie in a row that we've reviewed that had a big cat getting set loose.
Yeah.
Last week it was a lion, this time a tiger. I really didn't get that scene where he's talking to the chemist as he's credited.
Oh, yeah. That whole scene is just fucked up.
Because apparently he sees this radio tower in a vision and then goes to the tower and finds this guy who with a pet tiger who tells him after a bit of coaxing tells him where the cult is located.
Yeah, he kind of stares at him. They don't Nick Cage doesn't actually talk in that scene, I don't think.
No, not at all.
He just the chemist just I guess you're right. Okay. You look lots of loose like he's having one side of dialogue.
And I think he was looking more at the cat because he just pointed out the cat at that point, the lion or tiger. And I think he was talking to the tiger when he said that, like the tiger said something to him that convinced him. Yeah, he's right. I should tell him where the cult is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll tell him. They went north.
Yeah. So he goes after the cult on an ATV that he got somewhere.
It was one of the dark skull.
Oh, okay. No, it wasn't a motorcycle. It was an ATV. It was a four-wheeler.
I thought they were riding those.
Were they? Okay. I assumed it was motorcycles because of the, outfits. But okay, maybe they were. And I like the build-up to that confrontation because they take it nice and slow and methodical.
Yeah.
Although I have to wonder why he let Sister Lucy live. He comes up on this van with Brother Swan, who called the Black Skulls earlier, murders him. But Sister Lucy, the 20-something girl who's a part of the cult, is with him, and he just lets her go away.
I got that because she wasn't really a part of any of it.
Okay, she wasn't there when she was burned?
In fact, remember, he played the Russian roulette
right
with her in front of him. Mm-hmm. So she was just completely...
He was brainwashed completely, right?
Yeah. She didn't do anything to help, obviously, but she was just kind of paralyzed, it seemed like.
I think it was right before Mandy was burned, or was it right after? Anyway, in that scene, to show how much power he has, Jeremiah has his sister Lucy kneel down in front of Cage, and you think it's going to go somewhere else. Then he hands her this pistol, cocks it, and puts a bullet in, cocks it, and has her, you know, play Russian roulette with it, just to prove how much control he has.
Right. So it was kind of a fuck you to the cult to let her go.
Yeah. Then he goes after the second and third members of the cult. One he just decapitates with the axe.
Yeah.
The other he has a chainsaw fight with.
Oh, right. That was beautiful.
And the other guy, he's got just a normal size chainsaw. He's a lumberjack. He knows how to work a chainsaw.
Yeah.
The other guy's got this chainsaw with this like 6-foot blade on it.
I'd almost suggest a Chekhov's chainsaw, actually, yes, for a title.
And if he had said groovy before picking up the chainsaw, it would have been an easy 6. Because not many movies have a chainsaw fight. And when you have a chainsaw, you really should reference Ash.
Yeah.
Then he finds Mother Marlene, the mother, you know, I don't know if she's Jeremiah's wife or something. The other leader of the cult finds her. You think she's going to seduce him. They kind of cut away from the scene. And then he continues on to find Jeremiah and tosses her head in.
At this point, though, you know he's not being seduced. He's not. Well, no. You know he's not going to come that far.
Right, right.
Just to be seduced by her. And he remembers her, you know, like, kind of cheering on the events. Mm-hmm. Like, see, he let the one live that was just kind of sitting there blank and didn't right. do anything. Uh-huh. But she was all like, yeah, you kind of get her kind of thing.
She was hype, man.
Oh, yeah. So,
yeah.
But she was dead.
He throws her head in. And then he quotes Joseph Campbell. When he gets to Jeremiah. Yeah, toward the end of the film, Red tells the cult leader that the psychotic drowns where the mystic swims. It's a variation of a quote by Joseph Campbell. The psychotic drowns in the same waters in which the mystic swims with delight. meaning that there's a fine line between psychosis and spirituality. And he says that he's the mystic and Jeremiah is the psychotic. Jeremiah is, I don't know if either of them are technically psychotic, you know,
like the crazy vocal here. Distortion that he now suddenly has because he's
right.
Like
some kind of superhero.
Yeah.
And then it's just a very simple kill. Jeremiah kneels down to beg for his life. Red puts his hands on the side of his head and just sits there for a while and just lets him rant. At one point, Jeremiah offers him a blowjob. I don't know why he thought that would be a compelling offer.
They both try to seduce him.
And then he just crushes his head. And it's beautifully fake.
Yeah.
It's clearly a plastic head. And they just go full trauma on the gore there.
There's a lot of trauma in this film. Yeah. I mean, like the vomiting of blood onto him, the baptism of blood he gets.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, when he kills the guy with the chainsaw, he dies over top of him. And he just vomits blood all over his face, yes. He drives away. He, of course, imagines Mandy sitting next to him. And then as he's driving away, the forest turns into this alien landscape. I have no idea what that was supposed to mean. And oddly, there was no music during the credits. It was a really bold choice.
No, very quiet. That's where they should have had the environmental sounds.
Yeah. And then showing Mandy's drawings after the credits was a nice touch.
Yeah.
This is a little remembrance. By the way, the production used Arri Alexa cameras coupled with Panavision anamorphic format to achieve an old school atmosphere. So wow. they went Panavision on this one.
That explains it. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite filmed like this.
And it received a 4-minute standing ovation at Cannes.
I mean, there's a few things that are, you know, very unique about this. I mean, one, he pretty much made a slasher film where the slasher is the good guy.
Yeah, yeah. It's a revenge film. It is a revenge film.
Right.
But he goes way over the top with the gore and the violence.
Right, right.
So, sequels and remakes?
They've obviously set up something for a sequel there, right? At the end, them driving off together.
He drives off. He lets Sister Lucy live. That could lead to a sequel.
Yeah, I don't know if Sister Lucy would play any part in this. I think she would just go and get deprogrammed somewhere.
Hopefully, but I'm thinking there's a little room for a sequel there.
There's a lot of people that believe there are a lot of references to serial killers in this also. You know, obviously the Manson family.
Right.
They think the number 44, which is used a few times.
What is that? That is a reference to something. I can't remember what it is, though. I don't have it in my notes.
Well, I think there was like the Son of Sam.
Okay.
And, you know, and the fact that, you know, is he now a serial killer himself? You know, I don't know. I remember it was his favorite shirt.
So, yeah, they could go in a couple of directions. Although, given what Cosmato said about it being, you know, the exhale to Black Rainbow's inhale, I don't think he's going to go with a direct sequel.
Right. This is not a guy that just works in that way. He's going to do something else strange after this. So that's probably not going to be like anything.
No. This is very different from Black Rainbow. I'm sure he'll do something. But it has some common there are some similarities.
There are some similarities.
Some stylistic similarities. I'm sure there'll be something very different with some styles. His next film will be something very different with, again, similar elements. So
like this was a lot more Shining.
Yeah.
Beyond the Black Rainbow, it was a lot 2001.
Yes, yes.
Where it was just, what?
On to brains. I got to go five. This was just a blast from top to bottom.
This is like what Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon for, you know, revenge horror movies. Yeah. Just beautifully shot from the beginning to end. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the plot is about as simple as you can get. It's almost a Charles Bronson film. but
it's deliberately so.
But it is so beautifully shot. Even the crazy gore and the references are, of course, more subtle than Stranger Things. Yeah, you got to go five.
All right. And what have we learned?
We learned what's black and white in this all over.
Now I learned that the cleansing power of fire cannot be reasoned with. That's it for Mandy. Until next time, we'll be reviewing Ballistic X versus Sever. We're taking another drastic turn here. Apparently, this is the lowest rated film or worst reviewed film on Rotten Tomatoes. I've seen it. It is far from the worst film we've seen.
I'm trying to remember what I've seen of this, but I've heard of it.
It's been on our list forever. I saw it years ago. Lucy Liu, Antonio Banderas, and as spies who end up teaming up together against a common enemy. It's not good, but it's far from the worst we've seen. Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.